I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, which ahead of this week's Witkoff trip to Moscow, hosted Russia-USA talks in Abu Dhabi to try and end the NATO proxy war on Moscow and prevent the conflict catalyzing nuclear war. This while, despite a Trump-organized deal on Gaza enshrined in a UN Security Council resolution 2803, the Israeli genocide continues in Gaza with continuing UK-US EU armed bombing of Lebanon and Syria too. Professor Stephen Simon was Senior Director for Transnational Threats at the U.S. National Security Council under Bill Clinton and later Senior Director for Middle East and North Africa under Libya butcher Obama. He advised the court of Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed here in the UAE and is now a distinguished visiting fellow at Dartmouth College. He's in Maine in the USA. Thank you so much, Professor Simon, for being on the show. I want to get to the Middle East, but even as EU defense and war ministers are with NATO, Secretary General Rutte meeting in Brussels, and Ukraine's war minister, Witkoff, preparing for Moscow, I mean, given that you were in the National Security Council for the Middle East region, I have to ask you what you thought when you saw Trump's ambassador to Israel, Huckabee, meeting with the Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard in the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. What did it make you feel as a ex-National Security, U.S. National Security Council senior official with the expertise in counterterror?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wasn't surprised at all. Pollard is a hero to the right wing in Israel, and Mike Huckabee is a hero to them as well. They have a lot in common. The Trump administration.
Hang on. This is the representative of the United States. I know it's Huckabee, a human being, but this is the U.S. representative in Israel.
Sure. Yes, but the Trump administration takes a very, I guess, transgressive view of international relations, and they really enjoy overturning the conventions of the previous era. And, in the previous era, it would have been unthinkable for the U.S. ambassador to Israel to meet with Pollard. But I think the Trump administration takes great pleasure in overturning those conventions. On the other hand, you could say, well, you know, Pollard served his sentence. He served it completely. He was paroled in 2015. And
There was a recommendation. There was a recommendation for a life term. To those in our audience who don't know who he is, just remind us. I mean, U.S. intercept data, nuclear secrets, U.S. assets in the region, the names of them, where United States intelligence was weak, the biggest breach of United States intelligence in its history hitherto, all given away to Israel in the mid-80s, some of it to the then Soviet Union, where it was recommended he had life imprisonment. I mean, just remind us who he was.
Well, Jonathan Pollard was a civilian analyst in naval intelligence, and he turned over many documents, not finished intelligence, as far as I'm aware, but mostly, not raw intelligence, but mostly finished intelligence, reports of analysts and so forth about events in the region and outside of the region. It was a vast amount of documentation, and His theft of that information went on for several years before it was finally exposed. He was his conviction was controversial in the United States, in part because even though he handed over a vast amount of information to Israel, it was not much of it was not hugely sensitive. The other spies in the recent history in the United States transferred raw intelligence that actually did confer on America's enemies directly the position of U.S. submarines, very delicate technological information, and even led to the execution of American agents in the
Soviet Union. Who are you thinking of then?
It's a very, very, very touchy situation because people wondered why Pollard was given such a stiff sentence when, in reality, what he did was not terribly damaging to U.S. interest. But nevertheless, he did pass over secrets, and he was convicted of espionage. And that, you know, really makes it quite remarkable.
Yeah, I'm not sure you're thinking of who did worse. Anyway, I mean, I suppose the main point as regards geopolitics today is, what does it signify in terms of the power relations between Israel and the United States, that someone who works against the United States is greeted so warmly, was a friendly, described as a friendly meeting by Trump's ambassador in Israel with a known spy who was trying to destabilize, in effect, the United States' national security?
Yeah, well, as I indicated, it was quite remarkable. But, you know, Huckabee is really cut from different cloth. And remember, too, and this might be useful for the ongoing conversation we're having. It's useful to remember that there is no Congress now involved in U.S. foreign policy making. Congress has essentially abdicated its role. So the Trump administration can do whatever it wishes to do without fear of political blowback, paying a political price in Congress or with its electoral base. So there are no restraints on this administration. And Mike Huckabee, in particular, he's an evangelical Christian. He's always been an outspoken supporter of Israel and a strong U.S.-Israeli relationship. And he's just not going to be attentive to the old norms that would have made it unthinkable for such a meeting to happen. And what he did, the reason that the meeting took place was because this ambassador is pandering to the extreme right wing in Israel. And this is a good way to do it. Nothing really puts you in the good graces of the right wing as legitimizing what Jonathan Pollard did. You know, that's, if I were ambassador, I would not have met with Jonathan Pollard.
Maybe that's why you're not ambassador. Maybe that's why you're not ambassador. But by Trump administration, when you use that phrase, clearly we don't mean the grassroots that got him elected, because the MAGA base is clearly opposing the Make Israel Great Again movement. So what do we mean? Do we mean Miriam Adelson's money? Do we mean Jeffrey Epstein's information? What is the Trump administration when we describe its relation to Israel?
That's also a terrific question. It's difficult to determine, really, because Trump himself seems to have no foreign policy compass. In other words, there seems to be no strong impulse that regulates his preferences in terms of foreign policy. So one minute he can be supporting Ukraine, the next minute he can be supporting Russia. It's really difficult to tell. One minute he can say he's really interested in negotiations with Iran, and then the next minute he can be joining the Israelis in attacking Iranian nuclear sites. One minute he can say, you know, annexation is of the West Bank is just fine. And the next minute he can say, well, no, the United States opposes annexation. One minute he can say, well, you know, the Palestinians in Gaza should simply be displaced and put in other countries. And the next minute, you know, he can say, well, I've got a 20-point plan that...
In fairness for the people of Gaza, he has managed to prevent... the kind of genocide that was occurring under Joe Biden. I mean, eventually. In fact, on that, I don't know what you think of the Security Council 2803 and whether you think that Russia and China may have lost standing because they abstained rather than vetoed the Trump resolution on basically Trump running Gaza. Do you think Russia and China have lost some standing in the so-called Arab street for going along with this?
Well, typically the Russians don't pay a penalty on the Arab street or within Arab governments for the stances that they take or don't take. It's the Russian immunity to this sort of blowback is notable over time. And it was especially notable during the Syrian civil war, when Russia enthusiastically and crucially backed Bashar al-Assad in the Civil War, and sided with Iran in that conflict. So so the Russians were backing, in a sense, the wrong guy. You know, if you're in the Arab world, they were backing Bashar al-Assad, but there was no blowback. He was quite welcome in the Gulf during this period, and there were no demonstrations against Russia, nobody setting fire to Russian embassies or anything like that.
I mean, I should say, just before Assad left, Assad was welcomed here in the United Arab Emirates as well, as he was.
Assad had close ties with leadership in the UAE at that time, and it was the UAE ultimately that severed those ties as the civil war advanced and became bloodier. Those ties have now been restored, you know, as we know. But
it renewed them before Assad left. I mean, why it's so important, speaking to you, of course, is you were on the U.S. National Security Council in 2011 when the protests broke out in Dara. I mean, what do you think the genocide in Gaza could have happened with if Assad had been in power in Damascus? Was eliminating the Assad government a very important and weakening it a very important part of Israel's ability to carry out the genocide?
You know, I see two wars happening in the Middle East. There's the war between Israel and the Palestinians on the one hand, and on the other, there are conventional wars, if I can put it that way, secular wars that are happening between Israel and its neighbors. And the motivations for those wars differ, and the way in which those wars are carried out differ. And I think that what happened in Gaza would have happened regardless of the state of affairs in Damascus politically. You know, whoever was in charge, I don't think that would have affected.
It weakened the Northern Front clearly. And of course, the reason why I'm asking is because you were there when the administration was clearly trying to weaken Assad. I should ask you what you felt when you saw Jolani, someone who you didn't favor the funding of when you were at the National Security Council, as you've outlined in Foreign Affairs. What did you think when you saw him in the Oval Office?
Well, it was another example of the transgressiveness of Trump's foreign policy. You know, Trump, and this can be good and bad, by the way. I'm not making a sweeping judgment here. I mean, sometimes it's good to just, you know, drop old prejudices and drop failed policies and move on and try something different. And that assessment could apply to Trump as well, but in any case, having Jolani in the White House in the Oval Office was a great example of Trump's willingness to discard the old verities and move in a new direction. And he had a strong reason for doing it, of course, and that was taking into account Saudi interests. The Saudis, really wanted the United States to patch things up with Syria and to support Ahmed al-Sharaa. So,
they wanted to patch it up with Assad as well. But anyway, I'll stop you there, Professor Stephen Simon. I'll stop you there. More from the former U.S. National Security Council senior official after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Stephen Simon, a former U.S. National Security Council senior official in the Clinton and Obama administrations. Professor Simon, I was rudely interrupting you when you were talking about the rapprochements with former al-Qaeda ISIS commanders in Syria. You backed, when you were at the National Security Council, you didn't back ISIS, Daesh, and al-Qaeda. People can watch our interview with the former CIA Chief of Station Tel Aviv, Susan Miller, who didn't seem to know about Timber Sycamore, the covert action to support the rebels. You were opposed to that. Why did you support Fursan al-Haq, Knights of Justice, and Farouk battalions? Why on earth were you meddling anyway in Syria in the National Security Council in the United States?
Well, you know, one might justifiably ask that question. Obama was very resistant to doing anything of the kind, and he was finally persuaded to do it, I think, for a couple of reasons. The one was that our Arab partners were very eager for the United States to lead an effort of that kind to weaken Assad or perhaps even overthrow him. And our alliance relations with the Gulf Arabs were a very important factor. The other thing was the intractability of the conflict, because the casualties were mounting. There were tens of thousands of people being killed.
They were being killed with American money and weapons, weren't they? I mean, I know there were Turkish weapons there as well. That's the reason. I mean, someone could say that your support for these local coordination committees, it was all infested with Mossad. It was all infested with American taxpayer money. And actually, it was basically the PR cover for Islamists was saying, oh, give it to some rebels, not the other. I mean, even if the Saudis, even if any country wanted you to intervene, the ordinary U.S. taxpayer wouldn't want the United States to be paying for this.
Well, for, you know, perhaps. I mean, one doesn't know. I mean, that was... I am told a covert operation, which means that it was meant to be deniable. So the American people did not know what was going on in Syria. They would have had no way of knowing until the program actually leaked, and even then it attracted very little attention. But it was a huge program. It was probably the largest such program that the United States ever staged. No doubt about the size of it, but they were policy goals. It wasn't just a matter of, I don't know, buying weapons and so forth. There were policy goals in Syria itself. You know, one could argue that the policy goal, whether you like it or you don't like it, was almost achieved. And this is why the Russians intervened in 2015. And the first targets that the Russians hit were the groups that were supported by the United States, because from a Russian perspective, it did look as though the U.S. program was poised to seriously weaken and possibly overthrow Moscow's man in Damascus, and they were not going to tolerate that. So I don't think the Russians would have reacted in that way if they felt that the American program was ineffective. So, you know, one day the files will be, on Wikipedia or something, and we'll all get the ground truth. But I think the situation is a little bit complicated. But my preference was not to intervene in that way. There were others who felt that same way. But, you know, in government, you have to, I mean, if you're serving in government, you know, what the president wants is pretty important.
Yeah, but you said Obama didn't really care either way. I don't think Wikipedia will tell us, by the way, in any case. But then, so would you have been aware, I don't know whether this was after your time at the National Security Council, of the infamous memo from Jake Sullivan to Hillary Clinton, saying, see last item, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. Otherwise, things have basically turned out as expected. Did you know that Sullivan would, that he'd written that to Clinton?
No.
I mean, I'm sure you've seen it by now, the unclassified Department of State email. But was that generally what you felt at the State Department? They knew they were Obama was basically on the side of Al-Qaeda?
Well, let me say two things about that. First, the State Department was in a kind of peculiar position. The State Department actually was the strongest advocate within government of using force against Assad.
Hillary Clinton.
Yes, that was true of Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta, who was her counterpart at the Defense Department. At the CIA, General David Petraeus was a serious advocate of toppling Assad. So, those you know, those three, that triumvirate, were very concerned to get the United States in there and, as Hillary Clinton and Leon Panetta like to say, put some skin in the game. In other words, you know, there was a view at the State Department that the United States couldn't hope to have any influence in the future in Syria if it didn't get involved in a serious, practical way during the civil war. But Obama resisted that argument, and he resisted it really until pressure from Arab allies and the situation on the ground in Syria just induced a kind of desperation, you know, a feeling that, well, we've got to do something. And that we've got to do something feeling has gotten the United States into trouble on many occasions. But it's a very American instinct.
You're avoiding saying that actually that something usually has something to do with Israel. I mean, I must emphasize the relevance to today is that only the other day Palestinians were polled in the West Bank saying things are worse for them and things are worse for Syria. I think it went since Assad is gone. So in that sense, it was a crucial part for creating the landscape in which to have the genocide. I mean, now, of course, one knock-on effect of all of that is the imminent, we don't know how imminent, attack, a renewed attack we might be able to expect from Israel and the Trump administration, perhaps, on Iran. You warned against Trump's capitulation to the Israel lobby before about the so-called 12-day war. Do you think from Iran's perspective, they better get nuclear weapons quick and ignore Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa against nuclear weapons, get that 400 kilos that are missing working to enforce deterrence?
Well, the Iranians still have enough fissile material to pull together, let's say, 6 or 8 warheads. In other words, when the United States and Israel struck Iran, Operation Midnight Hammer and Rising Lion, or you know, the code names for those operations, they the Iranians managed to save a substantial amount of their fissile material. So the Iranians, if they choose to, can restart a process of enrichment and build a weapon if they so choose. It's not clear that Iran, at least this is the view of the United States intelligence agencies, it's not clear that Iran has made a decision, you know, the serious strategic decision of building a nuclear weapon.
But if you were on the National Security Council of Iran, rather than a former National Security Council Middle East senior official in the United States under two presidents, presumably you'd be advising the Iranian leadership to enrich? What can save them otherwise?
I think they'd have to express a serious interest in negotiations, but they're moving away from that position, and one can see.
Well, surely there's no point in negotiations. There's no point in. I mean, you can understand from the Iran's point of view. There's certainly no point in negotiating.
Absolutely. The Iranians would have to do what would not come naturally under these circumstances. They would have to make it absolutely clear that they were willing to accept limits on enrichment, and that's a red line for the Iranians. They haven't agreed to do it until now, and the United States, initially under Trump, by the way, came to a decision that the Iranians would never be moved off that position, and the United States was going to have to accept a certain level of enrichment, as was accepted under the 2015, U.S., European, and Iranian nuclear deal. But But then they changed their mind, and they changed their mind, no doubtedly, because of Israeli pressure. There's no question about that. They didn't have to change their mind, but anyway, they did, and that led, to those strikes. And in the wake of those strikes, it would be quite understandable for the Iranians just to say, "Listen, we're never going to talk to you guys again, because you know you talk about talk, but then you use force, and that's just not going to work for us." On the other hand, if they don't, suppress these instincts, then they might well be attacked again, especially since they do have this remaining supply of fissile material that no doubt the Israelis and probably the U.S. are looking for really hard and would like to destroy.
Yeah, and also, obviously, Israel and the United States, and supported or armed by the United States, Europe and Western Europe, they have a habit of bombing Iran during negotiations and bombing others during negotiations, even when they're in Qatar. Just finally, I better ask you then, I mean, on Jalani, while the rest of the world is looking to Venezuela, perhaps a war on Iran and the Ukraine negotiations, how long do you give Jalani, seen from where you are as a scholar at the Quincy Institute? Do you think he can last that long? Will we be measuring the days from that Oval Office photo call?
Well, I'm actually going to be in Syria again very, very shortly. And the questions I will have for my friends there is, what was the reaction among Jolani's constituents, you know, the groups within his coalition? What was the reaction to the Oval Office meeting? I mean, that's a key point of information. But here's a thing. My Syrian expert friends take the view that Jolani had already weeded out the serious hardliners from his coalition even before he took power in December of last year, and that it is unlikely, in their view, that there is enough of a core of a resistance, you know, from the right on to Jalani's policies and his approach to the United States and to Israel, I might add, that they feel that there's not enough resistance there now to generate.
We're out of time, Professor. Alas, I seem to remember that kind of thing being talked about Osama bin Laden back in the day. But you'll have to come back on and remind us about that, Professor Stephen Simon. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's it for the show. We'll be back on Saturday when we'll be showing you one of your favorite episodes of this season. On Monday, we'll be back with the journalist who lost 21 family members to Israel's Gaza genocide. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US EU-armed genocide across Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.